and welcome to another episode of Radio War Nerd. The date today is February 17th, 2023, and this is episode 367. You're listening to Radio War Nerd at patreon.com/Radio War Nerd for subscribers. And I am the co-host, Mark Ames, here in Rochester, New York, still licking my wounds. And I'm on the line with John Dolan, a.k.a. Gary Bredger, a.k.a. the War Nerd, in Glasgow, right?
Near Glasgow, Clydebank.
Clydebank, okay.
Clydebank in February. They say there's nothing like it.
And is there?
Well, if wet, you like cold, howling wind.
Okay, howling wind.
No, thank God, not foggy. It's got howling wind, which when you're in a warm hotel room can be really fun, you know, just listening to those noises out there. It made me nostalgic for Dunedin. And I've said before that I'd never heard howling wind outdoors while I was inside in California because there isn't that much wind. But got to Dunedin and there's actually howling wind. And the people who came to Dunedin came from here, a lot of them. So they must have thought the whole world was nothing but howling wind.
We get real howling wind here, and we have those tall, very tall kind of thin trees that really creak and sway and sometimes fall. I mean, a tree, you know, 50, 60, 70-foot tree, whatever, you know, falling on your roof or on your car is a real problem out here.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it would kill you, I would think, if you were unlucky enough to be under it.
Yeah. So looking forward to our discussion today, our talk today with Ann Newman about Ethiopia. I mean, so hard to find anybody to talk to about the Ethiopian war. And she actually got there. She got inside for Harper's Magazine, and we'll get to that. Before then, I don't know, any follow-up on the Hirsch interview that we did. You know, it got a lot of play, that's for sure, because we got the first, sort of like the good and the bad about getting the first exclusive on a giant shitstorm bombshell story like that is, you know, I've read some of Hirsch's interviews since then, and he's more open and more relaxed. And so some of the interviews could be a bit more relaxed and a bit more open. And, you know, with us, I mean, you heard him even like before the show, like the first thing he yelled at is, you're not going to, what did he say? It's like, you're not going to have me go over the story, are you? You're not going to have me retell the story, are you? So it was like, whoop, I better scratch off about half of these questions here right now. Because it was clear he was like, he had his finger on the hang up button. And he was just like, I fucking dare you. And actually, F-bombs, he didn't. I don't think he did any F-bombs in the interview, but when I...
Well, either he didn't do them or who cared at that point. I mean, he didn't need four-letter words. He's terrifying.
No. Yeah. In fact, when he was in the pre-interview, there were more four-letter words than I'd like my kids to hear. But he was a lot friendlier, too. He was not as aggressive. And I get it. I get why... It was thrilling. It was harrowing and it was thrilling. But I get why he did it, because here he's put out this story, and I can tell you there's a lot of stuff that we're told more in confidence that we can't talk about. But, you know, if you're wondering why, even now, it's been a little over a week now since the story came out, and there's still nothing in the elite Anglo world press, not in New York Times, not in Washington Post, not in our state government media, you know, NPR, BBC News. I mean, the blackout on it is, it's creepy in part because you can see it. You watch the blackout happening. We all talk about it. We all know it. And they're still doing it. It's pretty damn weird. But I know
that is weird because
it is.
Yeah. It's like they think they can still black it out completely without blacking out all electronic media, which was what happened in Ethiopia in the war we'll be talking about. But you really can't do that. And the good news that I've seen is that I've been trying to track that story since we did the interview. Well, since you did the interview, Mark, I wasn't much involved except to screech and grovel occasionally. The blackout doesn't seem to be working because there are stages or phases of establishment sneering. And when they think they've got you contained, they say, oh, it's a sad, sad thing to watch. Yes. There was actually a story exactly like that, like in the South China Morning Post, which internationally is a pretty big site. And the reporter was saying, don't be too hard on Seymour Hirsch, which is the ultimate
guy who's never done a story in his life says, don't be too hard on him, looking down his nose. Yeah.
And and then Tablet, which is like the quasi-progressive Jewish magazine, used a baseball metaphor, I think. Seymour Hirsch swings and misses big. Oh, and it was all sort of, poor old guy. And that's not the case anymore, where you get reactions. And, of course, the A-level publications are not reacting at all. But where they do react, there's real anger now. They're not pretending anymore.
Yeah, it's not working. It's kind of, it's interesting to watch. I mean, it's actually spreading around, coursing through the veins a lot more now than it did a week ago when there was a lot of effort initially put into belittling it. And a lot of that effort was all about belittling it. A big line of argument was, he relied on one anonymous source. Well, that's one thing we teased out of him. He did not rely. And we knew it anyway. But anybody who said, any blue check, any OSINT guy who said he, you know, whose line of attack was he relied on one anonymous source and didn't ask Hirsch if he only relied on, just judged by a bad faith reading, you can dismiss that person for good. I mean, I just call up here a few of those people. Here's our good friend Elliot Higgins. Seymour Hirsch's latest claims the Nord Stream pipeline was blown up by the U.S. can be most easily summarized by his line, quote, according to a source with direct knowledge of the operational planning, unquote. And here's Crystal Gurozev, also of Bellingcat. I hope I won't live to become as senile, as corrupt, or as obsessively lying. This is a guy paid by the U.S. government, by the way.
Senile?
Or as obsessively lying as Seymour Hirsch. So he's both senile and obsessively lying? If you're senile, you can't.
Well, I mean, the senile thing is ridiculous. He's as sharp as a straight razor.
These are just lies. Whose irresponsible single anonymous source reporting by a name with legacy authority is among the worst damage to journalism anyone ever caused. TLDR, total fiction. That's Bellingcat paid. Here's another. This is interesting, I thought, because when Hirsch put out his book on the downing of Flight 007, The Target Is Destroyed, which you've talked about before. One of the things, he goes out there and investigates every claim, including Soviet claims that KL-007 was actually a spy plane. And he says, no, it wasn't, but they definitely genuinely believed it and were made very paranoid by all sorts of actual spy plane incursions. And he also got, although he didn't get the full goods on it, but he was basically there, that the U.S. manipulated what was a Soviet shoot down, but manipulated the tapes and manipulated the whole story to make it seem like they deliberately, knowingly shot down a civilian airliner because they have no value of human life in the Soviet Union. And before the book got published, a couple months before, Bill Casey, the head of the CIA under Reagan, called Hirsch at his home and said, if you publish it, you can be criminally prosecuted because you'll be revealing secrets that can allow you to be criminally prosecuted. And he called the head of Random House and threatened the same. And they published it anyway, and no one was prosecuted. But it's just kind of ironic that several decades later, you have, you know, Crystal Gurozev, Elliot Higgins. Here's another one of these. Let me see where it is here. Natalia Antelava, she's head of Coda Story, which is also funded by the National Endowment. So you have all these people funded by the National Endowment for Democracy, which is the brainchild of William Casey. He He seconded it out, but that was his idea for
We did a whole show on the National Endowment.
Yes. So these people are taking money for the National Endowment for Democracy, and now they're out there discrediting or trying to discredit Hirsch's story. It's like,
yeah,
it's like Al Davis's, you know, like it's like Al Davis keeps poisoning everything for the Raiders. Bill Casey keeps poisoning everything just in the world, you know, even from the grave.
What struck me as all this started to fracture is a story that I remembered, and I wish I'd asked, before I was cut off, I wish I'd asked Seymour about, which seems important to me, which is Sweden and Denmark both started investigations of the pipeline blast. They both finished those investigations, and then they decided not to release the results or talk about them in public. That's kind of interesting.
Oh, yeah. And
it seems like it could trigger some useful journalistic curiosity, but it doesn't seem to have done so.
Well, even like, you know, what's amazing is even the Washington Post in late December reported that that the European officials told them that there's no evidence that the Russians did it. And in fact, even more European officials, unnamed, said they doubted Russia had anything to do with it. And that's it. That's the end of the story. Move on.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Okay, well, there's nobody else then. It's one of the allies. It's the U.S. or Ukraine or, you know, a lot of, I mean, when we were trying to think of other people brainstorming this, who would have been the culprit, not many people actually thought it was the U.S. Most thought Poland, like I thought, if it wasn't them, it was like Poland or the U.K. with sort of a U.S. nod. But I think, as you pointed out, John, not a lot of people have that capability to pull off an underwater operation.
No, the U.S. and the U.K. are marine powers. They're good at air, sea, combined arms operations. Russia's never been very good at that. They keep getting propped up as a coming power in that area when the U.S. and British navies need more money, but they never quite get there. Both the British and the U.S. navies, and probably some of the Scandinavian navies, do have that ability and have a lot of experience.
Right. By the way, one other thing I want to say. I mean, I think most people who are listening by this time, you know, are on Team Hirsch with this story. But another line of smear, which is very common, you see it especially among leftists who don't like the story but don't want to say that they've always hated Hirsch. They want to let you know that they used to love Hirsch. He used to be great. I'd forgotten how much hate he brought on himself and how much he was sort of discredited by kind of the liberal left end of the journalism media world from his book on JFK, Camelot. It's a brutal book. JFK does not come off as a pacifist hero at all. It's absolutely savage. And there are even some controversies about some of the documents or sources he relied on that people used to really try to discredit him as a journalist, period. And I'm just going to read like something. Here's Gary Willis, who's a really, you know, is a really good writer and a big name. What he wrote in the New York Review of Books in, I don't know, 1999, 2000 or so, about Hirsch. He wrote, "It is an astonishing spectacle, this book. In his mad zeal to destroy Camelot, to raise it down, dance on the rubble, and sow salt on the ground where it stood, Hirsch has, with precision and method, disassembled and obliterated his own career and reputation." Sounds familiar, doesn't it? Then, of course, he goes on to do the Abu Ghraib story. So it's like there's never been a time where people in his career said, I mean, they've always been saying he used to be good. Now he's destroyed his reputation. We no longer have to listen to him. Over and over and over. It's not an argument against the story that he used to be good and now he's lost it, you know, because it's
been used. Well, the other argument against the story is even less germane, as they used to say, which is this is a story that gives aid and comfort to Russia.
Yes.
It's like, okay. You know, I mean, that's not really the issue here. At the moment, a whodunit, a pretty straightforward mystery. Something happened, who did it? And with those things, you're sort of actually supposed to try to find the party who was guilty and let the chips fall where they may. You're not supposed to tailor your findings to a political agenda.
I mean, anything that makes America look bad is a gift to Russia. So don't do things like blow up your own allies' pipelines. I mean, you know, the whole Iraq war made Russia look better. I don't know. Yeah. Like, what can you say? The Afghanistan war, the expose on those Afghan papers and what we knew, all of that was a gift to Russia because it showed how corrupt and violent.
Well, I think there's been a kind of mental decline in the Acela Corridor elite.
Yes.
It came out again in this horrible story about East Palestine, Ohio, this wretched Appalachian town that was poisoned by a derailment of a train carrying very serious chemicals and running without proper regulations. And that story wasn't covered by any of the major media for a long time. And when that failure to cover the story became an issue in itself, the reaction was really frightening. Like, what do you expect? They voted for Trump. And that it's just a way of making us look bad. This especially Mayor Pete, because Mayor Pete is a hero because he fought in Afghanistan, if that makes you a hero. and you can't say anything bad about it. It was a dismal spectacle and showed the degree to which the whole discourse has become mutual snarling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. Anyways, let's move on from that to our big story for the day, which is the war in Ethiopia that we've discussed a lot on the show, that John, you've written about a lot. And so we have a guest who actually went to Ethiopia to report on what she saw and what she didn't see. So let's get to our interview with Anne Newman. Okay, we are really honored to have with us Anne Newman to talk about the war, or wars even, in Ethiopia. Anne is the author of a book, The Good Death, An Exploration of Dying in America. I feel like I have to read that. I'm kind of dreading it, but it's an important subject. I don't know what else you can say. Anyway, her work has also appeared in The New York Times, The Guardian, The Baffler, and Harper's Magazine, where her excellent article on Ethiopia was just published in the current issue, I believe. The article in Ethiopia, it's called Falling Like Leaves, The War in Ethiopia and Its Crimes Against Civilians. So first of all, welcome to the show, Anne, and thank you for coming on.
Thank you. If you ever need any information about end-of-life care, you just give me a call.
Really?
Yeah. Wow. I mean, tough. Always, but everyone should buy the book.
Yes.
However.
Yes. I mean, we're all going to be there one day, so, you know. Yeah.
Yes, indeed. Yeah.
Yeah.
And Falling Like Leaves, as comes out toward the end of the piece, is really a quote from an Ethiopian refugee that I met in Cairo. Mm. And he's talking about what it's like in his country right now.
Right. So, well, that brings us, I think, to the first question. I mean, look, we want to discuss a lot of things, the war in Ethiopia, of course, but also how you were able to get the story and write, because there has been almost no reporting whatsoever from inside Ethiopia. They've managed that really well. And then, you know, and then sort of larger questions about reporting in a country where all sorts of atrocities are going on and, you know, access is limited for obvious reasons. But anyway, but let's first start with how you got into this story, how you got into Ethiopia, and then sort of take it from there.
The story how I ended up getting into Ethiopia is two questions, right? Like, how did I go there for the reporting? But what actually interested me in this war when there was no one talking about it around us?
Right.
My father had been stationed on a U.S. Army base outside of Asmara, Eritrea in the 1960s before I was born. Mm. And that base is very special. And of course, at that time, Eritrea was part of Ethiopia. But that base was classified. My father never told us what he was doing. But for the most part, we know that Americans were using that Italian-built base, because Eritrea had been first an Italian colony. Right. They were using that Italian-built base to spy on the Russians. And so they were listening to the moon or the space program, and then it just kind of bled into the Cold War era. And so the Americans were there ultimately until 74, although my father was not. But the Americans were pushed out.
That's amazing, because one of the best books on the region is Michaela Wrong's book, I Didn't Do It For You.
Yes.
How the World Used and Abused a Small African Nation. And I think she talks about that specific base.
She does.
Which was inhabited sequentially by Italians, then British, then Americans.
Exactly. Yeah, that's the base. And she says it's still classified, but we know that this is what they were doing. And I think her book is beautiful, right? It, I actually was able to, we'll get to all of this, but I was able to go to Asmara and see the base in 2019 after Avi and Isaias made their peace. And I grabbed my sister and I said, we've got to go, because of course our whole lives were filled with artifacts and stories that my father brought back. In many ways, he was typical of his generation. I mean, my whole family is Mennonite from Lancaster, Pennsylvania. It's not like we get around a lot. And so, you know, so this was a big deal. I mean, not only did he join the army, which was not something that the Mennonites were doing at the time, but he ended up being this specialist in Ethiopia or now Eritrea. And so I have all of his letters. And so for a while, I've been working on a book about American empire and how it has, and its lifespan, you know, during my lifespan. Mm-hmm. I'm about 53 or 54. And so watching all of this, seeing Abi, taking my sister and going to Addis and then Asmara, and then seeing the promise of this country that I love in this white Western way, and that I have a relationship with in this, you know, post-colonial American empire way. But seeing the real damage that began on November 3rd, 2020, made me want to go. And I couldn't get enough information about it. And sure enough, we know it's because Abi was so good at closing down Tigray, at stifling information in and out of the country. And so I wrote a pitch about the story that kind of covered my personal connection, because I just wanted to be really straight up about it. You know, I didn't want to helicopter in and kind of write that, you know, that kind of story. Mm-hmm. And we rewrote the pitch. I pitched it to everybody. And Harper's, my beloved editor at Harper's, Katie Ryder, said, yeah, let's do this. And I was just about to apply for a visa. I decided to go in on a tourist visa, which just, I don't know, we can all criticize the things that we do.
Yeah, but it happens a lot in Russia and that area too. It's like the only way to more easily get in, but you can get in more trouble, right?
Totally. And, you know, I talked to all the experts and they were like, the worst thing that will happen to you likely, that word, likely, is that they'll deport you if they have a problem. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I'm just going to go in on a tourist visa. And then I broke my ankle. So I had a motorcycle accident and broke my ankle. And when I was walking again, I was like, I'm going, because you know, it's just like I didn't want to wait. But then, of course, this was the Tigrayans had pushed out of their territory and were advancing on Addis Ababa. I had a visa at this point. The State Department was sending me an email twice a day saying, don't go because we will not get you out. I don't know if any of you had any of those. Those emails are terrifying.
Yeah.
And also just, just relentless. And
because you had already told somebody there that you were planning on going, or you were just...
I applied for a tourist visa. And so I was on the list to receive the State Department emails that said, don't go.
Right.
So when the Tigrayans then retreated back to their borders, I I grabbed my bag and I ran. And, you know, I had like a little backpack. It's like we do, right? You mm-hmm. pack light, mm-hmm. you wear shoes that you can jog in, you like, mm-hmm. And I didn't know what to expect. I knew that I wouldn't try to get into Tigray. The war mm-hmm. was still going on. Mm-hmm. And I'm not that bang bang. I'm just not cut out right. for that. I think there are other people that do it and do it well.
Right.
And I ended
although few of them have actually gotten into Tigray. It's a big problem with this story.
It's a huge problem. But I think also, like, you know, there are a lot of things that the Ethiopian government, the Abiy administration, did right with this war as far as serving their own purposes, right? Like mm-hmm. their media handling, the misinformation online, all of that has been masterful.
Well, sadly. And then the most effective one is always just cutting the communications, which they did on the night of the 3rd and 4th of November when the war began.
Yeah, they cut everything, cell phones, internet, banking, just closed the borders.
So you would have been there at the end of June 2021, or at least that was the amazing TPLF recapture of, or TDF recapture of Mekelle. I mean, I remember that from outside, and I was trying very hard to follow the war, as one of the most stunning surprises of my lifetime, really. That was not supposed to happen. They were supposed to be easily defeated.
I wish we knew a lot more about how it had been done because it was just militarily impressive. Yeah. No, I would have headed there in September. So it would have been after that. And I ended up not going till the spring, of course. I ended up flying mid-March of 2022.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. So at that point, the TDF had been pushed back into the border of Tigray.
So they almost advanced on Addis Ababa. I remember all that, and people were freaking. And then they got pushed back. And we'll talk about all this as well. Then they got pushed back and back and back, all the way back into Tigray.
Right.
And that's around the time you got in. So that was right.
And there was a bit of a ceasefire then, right?
Right.
So, I had a guide, just because the term fixer is so problematic, basically this guy, you know, he was everything. His name is Mario, and I write about him in the piece.
Yes.
But he's a friend of a friend who had worked on a documentary, and Mario said, let's drive to Desi and then La Labella, and he wanted to do, like, this 12-day tour. And I was like, dude, I'm not equipped for that. I want an armed guard if I'm like, some of these areas are still hot. It's like, and he was like, well, let's go to La Labella because his brother was there. His whole family's there. La Labella had been occupied by the TPLF for about 5 months. And they had been gone for about 3 months by the time we got there. And so think of the conundrum that I was in. I was like, we know where the majority of the violence in this war has been taking place. It's you know, within Tigray, undoubtedly. It has been the site of the war all this time. But the only people I'm going to get to talk to are Amhara or, you know, pro-Abiy government.
And Amhara, who've been occupied by a vengeful TPLF or TDF, and who are going to be in a... this is the beauty of Abiy's management of communications, as you said. It was well done. It was effective.
So what I did was try to pre-game the reporting. I mean, first of all, I was afraid I'd get to Ethiopia and I wouldn't be able to leave the capital, or I wouldn't be able to find anyone to talk to me because Tigrayans had been detained all across the state. And so I stopped in Cairo, where I have some family friends, and it's a place that I return to all the time. It's just like my entryway to the continent all the time. And I said to myself, I'm just going to go find the Ethiopian restaurants, because we know there's an enormous Ethiopian and Eritrean refugee population in Cairo. And if I can talk to people there, you know, whether it was displaced Tigrayans or whatever. Well, as you know from the piece, I find a lot of Ethiopians and Eritreans, but their relationship to the war, they weren't Tigrayan. And I couldn't find any Tigrayans there.
No, I think the Tigrayans were laying low at the time.
Exactly.
They were being pogromed in Addis Ababa.
But why wouldn't there be so many Tigrayans? And I mean, I don't know much about the different diaspora communities. Like, John, I know you saw, like, in Toronto, right? A Tigrayan diaspora community kind of trying to protest.
Yeah.
Well, some of it's just numbers, right? Tigrayans make up 6% of the population. So they're a small number of a very large nation of like over 110 million.
So
there's that. But I think also, you know, I think the war was a flash. It was like there was a lot of saber rattling, but I don't think anyone could have imagined this. In many ways, Abiy's Western favor, the Nobel Peace Prize, all of that masked the real relationship they'd had with Azeez Afwerka in Eritrea.
You had to wonder, was there a secret clause in the treaty, like we're going to do a sandwich on Tigray, because it sure looked like that.
I just don't know how there couldn't be because of the way things went down.
It's so gruesome to think that the very thing that he was given the Nobel Prize for had a secret, basically genocide clause in it. You know, it's just it's really dark.
I would give that to Isaias Afwerka. I mean, he's a ruthless man. It's, you know, we could go on about this later, but it was a hell of a thing to be in Eritrea after, you know, in 2019.
I was wondering, was it hard to get in?
No, that was that glory period where everyone was flying back to see their family relatives. So my sister and I were on this plane, like the only white women in Eritrea at the time, unless, you know, it was like a handful of aid workers or something. And we had to register to go everywhere. No one would talk to us because we were so obvious. You can really see how the country has declined. But that's another story. And I really do believe that this war, after peace was signed, was inevitable.
And Afwerki has come out of it really strongly ahead. I mean, Abiy and his faction have paid a big price. Tigray has paid a horrible price. It'll take a while to find out how horrible.
Yeah.
But Eritrea, it had very little to lose. It was isolated anyway. Borders haven't even been broached.
No, and we're back strangely at this place where our conversation started, you know, that period of time where Western nations or other nations were fighting for African satellites, you know? It's a very strange thing that's taking place in the Horn now. It's like an odd, I was going to say regression, but that's not true. It's really a realignment. You know, you see all the surveys of African presidents or people who are asked about their feeling about Russia or China or the United States right now. And, you know, Pan-Africanism, which was very much a theme of this war, it's not doing much for the United States influence on the continent.
Right. That's interesting. So let's get back to your story. So this is really impressive, I got to say, just as a journalist, that you were able to find, this is where you found your guide or fixer, right? Was by talking to people in the restaurants.
The guide that I had in Cairo, yes.
Oh,
and
okay.
He's just like this young guy. He wasn't that great an interpreter. So I ended up audio recording everything. And then, you know, I had an interpreter translate everything for me, even though he was doing translation. And that was amazing. I found an individual who had been present in my cadre, which was one of the initial massacres in Western Tigray. Mm-hmm. And I know that John has talked quite a bit about the importance of Western Tigray and its significance in the war and even the state of, you know, that the peace deal doesn't address where that territory is going to go quite specifically enough for people to be comfortable. But so then the fixer that I did find for Ethiopia was a friend of a friend that I have in Brooklyn. And so he and I had a lot of communication before I got there. We met in Addis once I arrived. And then, you know, within 2 days, we flew to Lalibela. And the airports were just open. I think I was one of a handful of people who had been there, you know, outsiders, tourists who had been to the city. It's really a town, like a small city. And just to tell you about Lalibela, it's this UNESCO World Heritage Site in the 12th and 13th centuries. King Lalibela, and we can presume a host of workers carved these incredible churches out of solid stone. And many of them are below grade, below the ground, but they're just stunning. And of course, I was there during Lent, and I was deeply moved to be in this place without other tourists. You know, usually it's thronged with people coming to see. But a lot of people who live there saw me and were so thankful that their livelihood, tourism, was coming back.
Right. So the city lived. And we should tell listeners also where Lalibela is located, because it's pretty close to the Tigrayan border, isn't it?
Yeah. Like Raya, the other contested area that along with Western Tigray, is northeast of Lalibela. It's a 2-hour flight north of Addis. And, you know, probably after Aksum, probably the holiest city in the country. And you know, quite rural, but very Western, you know, very tourist-facing.
Yeah, you mentioned in the story that the TPLF or TDF troops might have been merciful because of the many historic churches in the area. And that raises a really interesting question about the place of religion in all this. It's sort of a, I mean, one of the things about Abiy is he's Pentecostal, and that's a very powerful rising demographic in a lot of sort of mid-income countries right now, although Ethiopia doesn't really qualify as mid-income, but aspirational countries, let's say. And the Tigrayans are very much Ethiopian Orthodox, and they would have valued this. Were there a lot of Pentecostals, or is Lalibela still pretty Orthodox?
Lalibela is definitely very Orthodox. But I think the nice thing, or the fascinating thing, right, why Pentecostalism spreads the way it does is that it's very syncretic with, you know, established religion there, and it works very well with the Ethiopian church. And so Abiy can use all of this aspirational language and, you know, unity talk and, you know, bootstraps type conversation, and that's his faith. And it works very well with individuals who believe that Ethiopia should go it alone, can rise on its own. And I mean, we can qualify all of that language as well. They still want American aid and other things, but they don't want meddling in internal policy. And internal policy at the moment is pretty grotesque.
Pretty brutal.
So I do think that religion, and we can get to that in a bit, right? There's a schism in the church at the moment. This is the, you know, the other war in Ethiopia, in Oromia, where some Oromo Abuna, or I guess they're like the equivalent of bishops in the Ethiopian Orthodox Church, have within the past 2 or 3 weeks declared independence. And broken away from the primary church. And I just saw a video, like within the past couple of days, of Abiy hugging, you know, the Abuna of the Ethiopian Orthodox Church, basically signifying his support for them.
For the ones who have withdrawn from the Congress overall?
No.
For the ones who stayed, yeah.
The ones who stayed.
Okay,
the mother church. Yeah.
So the Pentecostal wants to keep the mother church together because it's more like a state.
Yeah.
It's intertwined with the state, essentially, right? And I presume then that this is part, I mean, you see this in some wars or developing wars, like in Ukraine also, there's been a lot of schisming going on since 2014 that has a lot to do with separating from the bigger longtime brother ruler, whatever you call it. So is this about Oromia? It's tied in with Oromia independence as well, or?
Absolutely. The Abuna are saying our people want to worship in their own language.
Yeah.
You know, they want the autonomy to worship the way they wish. Yeah. And, you know, Oromia is, it's incredibly deadly.
Oh, that's amazing. So no more Gez. We want to worship in the Oromo language, like very, very odd Lutheran and Baptist echoes throughout all this.
Yeah. It's like a Vatican II, right? so that's taking place in this moment, So if we mm-hmm. want to talk about religion in Ethiopia, and yeah, I think Russian history is a great teacher. United States history is a great teacher mm-hmm. of the power yeah, of right. of faith in propelling leaders to power.
When you were in Lalibela, you met Fano. And can you explain Fano and then talk about meeting them?
Yeah, Fano are a militia group that is Amhara based. They believe deeply in Amhara oppression and are very much compelled to take up arms to restore their historic, they believe historic and rightful place as rulers of the country. So, and I've heard you talk about this in the past. Ethiopia has this Amharic history that is, you know, Haile Selassie brought it into modern times, sort of. And it's has to do with the story of Ethiopia and its founding rulers as descendants of King Solomon. And right. it's a compelling story. You know, there's footage of U.S. senators talking about this on the floor of the Senate chamber. It's not truth. There's very little to prove that it took place, but we know the power of story. And it is deeply compelling in this Amhara nationalism that that we've seen rise up, and you know, the Fano have swelled in numbers since the beginning of this war. I think they must have known what was coming at the start, like November 3rd or 4th. They gushed into Western Tigray. According to Amnesty International and other organizations, according to interviews that they've done with refugees, the Fano are implicated in some of the more gruesome killing that took place, or atrocities that took place, the rapes. It's just a war that's characterized by horrifying systematic rape and sexual abuse and violence. And the Fano, along with Eritreans, were right there. And it was, you know, because Lalibela had been held for 5 months, because the Amhara are deeply paranoid and feel that what they've got, everyone else wants. The Fano have started training in Lalibela. They don't want the, you know, the TDF to come back. And there were 200. We met a guy in a cafe, someone that Mario had known over a period of time, and he offered to take us to this Fano training. And so the next thing I know, I'm on a field at sunset with about 200 individuals of all ages, mostly men, but also some women. And they're learning how to assemble and disassemble Kalashnikov rifles in the field. And there's this one picture that I took that is just stunning. It's the trainers have laid out mats on the ground, and you know, the trainer's down on his knee showing everyone how to do this. And one of the trainers is hovering over a USAID food bag with his, you know, Kalashnikov rifle, showing these townspeople how to become soldiers.
Right.
It was just a stunning experience. You know, I have another, you know, the guys were handing around a hand grenade and, you know, telling me how to use it. This is how the serrated pieces come apart when it is live and thrown. You know, that sort of thing. It was just, I think I would have been scared if I hadn't been so fascinated. It was just stunning to see these.
You get scared later, right? When you think about it, you're like, wait a minute, what was I doing?
You know, my guy back in New York, I just didn't tell him about it. But it was, it did a couple of things for me. It made me realize how these men and women were just ordinary people compelled by a narrative and a sense of safety. You know, when the TDF came back, they were in Lalibela for a number of months and then pushed out and then came back again with vengeance. And, you know, the people in Lalibela did not want to experience that again. But it also taught me that reporting is reporting, right? Like, that's something that I think a lot of people who haven't had this experience, you know, I can report the story, any kind of story, but I didn't know that I could report that kind of story.
What do you mean?
Well, I mean, like, I was just there with my notepad and a recorder asking questions.
Mm.
And that felt very doable to me in the moment. I did not feel unsafe. And because I knew what had been taking place in the war, I knew what questions to ask. It was just, it reassured me that I was on the right track with the piece. And that's like a little sausage-making comment.
Yeah.
No, I think the sausage making is the most important thing here in some ways. Yeah. I think it's crucial because, I mean, at the back of your mind, there must have been the sense at the same time, like, you know, yes, there's definite suffering here, but, you know, what is the suffering in Ground Zero, like, you know, in provincial Tigray, because that's been effectively cut off from you.
Right, right. So that's what the piece had to be, right? It had to be what I could access, and then what I could report, and the data had to. If it was this bad here, what was it like in Tigray, where everything is hidden, where the soldier to civilian population is completely different, where soldiers were free to do what they wanted, without
especially Eritrean soldiers. I mean. The Eritreans were not under the very slight restraints that confronted the Ethiopian forces because really Afwerki had nothing to lose here.
Absolutely,
he wasn't going for a human rights champion of the year anytime soon.
Well, and every actually incentive to do as much damage as he could while he still had the opportunity, right? So it's like how much damage could he get in before? Maybe his deal with Abiy was no longer in service. So,
And I mean, the amount of damage they could do, there was no aid going in or out, no medicine going in or out. Just no one. It's stunning to me that we still aren't talking about it.
Yeah.
No, I think people don't understand how wartime famines, artificial famines, kill so much faster than guns. They destroy children first. The ones that you don't kill, they damage. And when you have a completely landlocked, very poor province like Tigray, you can kill a lot of people fast. And so we don't know the numbers. And I just have this feeling the numbers are going to be terrifying when they come out.
I think you're right, John.
What numbers do you have?
Jan Nyssen at Ghent has done the most extensive reporting on this. And he's saying as many as 800,000.
God.
And that's just civilians.
That is insane. Right.
You know, every time, you know, I'm talking to other groups or, you know, someone interviews me about this story and they're saying thousands dead. And I'm like, no, this is not thousands. This is hundreds of thousands. And then they're saying, yes, but not just civilians. And I'm like, no, we're just talking about civilians only.
Oh, yeah. The point of this kind of war is not to have big battles on the Gettysburg Stalingrad model. The point is to avoid them and to kill as many civilians as you can. Mm. That raises a question that I know you've talked about before, which is why don't the world media seem more interested in this?
I think the first one on the table is just racism, right? It's an African continent. They don't value their people. Right. Like, death is something different there than it is here.
Right.
And that's just pure racism. And secondly, we're accustomed to the Horn of Africa being a tumultuous and deadly place. You know, I grew up in the 80s where, you know, the Derg famine was really the only thing I knew about Ethiopia besides my father's stories, or as a population, that's the only thing we knew. So we have this sense that that's how people live there.
And
or
Black
die
Hawk
there.
Down, you know, is another.
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, Somalia's been a mess for a long time. Yeah. Sudan has a coup, and it's just we're accustomed to those stories. But we forget that these are individuals living through this horrifying history. And, you know, we have a lot to do with it. You know, however we want to think of ourselves as a world power, we have a responsibility, or at least we have a relationship with these countries. And this is happening as, you know, maybe the Ethiopian government is saying, we don't want American intervention, we're not your puppet. There's a lot of that sentiment, and certainly Abiy carries that well. But still, I mean, Western powers send a lot of aid to this country. To just let this go on is horrifying.
But that raises a question. I mean, what is the U.S.? I mean, let's be honest, the West is U.S.-led.
Yeah. Like,
what is their attitude towards this? Because there are some instances in the world which, you know, maybe they're not considered, they're not white, where the U.S. and the West does take an interest in the victims. And there are others where they sort of, they don't take that much of an interest, or they, you know, they kind of do the bare minimum to appear as if they're trying to do something. I mean, I don't, correct me if I'm wrong, but from what you've seen, but it seems to me that, you know, that there's a lot of concern from Washington and maybe a few other Western capitals, and they want this to stop, but they don't want to undermine their relationship with Abiy and Ethiopia, which has been an old important relationship, with Abiy and in the sort of the war on terror, like that goes back several years or a couple of decades even. Is that right,
Mark. Like even during TPLF dominance of the EPRDF, the prior party,
right.
27 years, they were not peaceful years.
Right.
We know that there were revolts and riots. And the United States, for the sake, I believe, of, you know, maintaining peace, maintaining a relationship in the Horn, you know, the United States' interest in Ethiopia has always been strategic.
Yes.
You know, it goes back to Kagnu Station, right? That's the lesson of all of this.
Yeah, that's where Michaela Wrong got the title for her book. Like, I didn't do it for you.
Right.
That was originally spoken by a British soldier being cheered by Eritreans after defeating the Italian fascist troops. And he sneers at the Eritrean, "I didn't do it for you."
That's a beautiful book. If anyone's looking for something we'll to read about the Horn, it's a very gorgeous book. She's just a beautiful writer. Nick Turse has done some really fantastic reporting at The Intercept about, you know, in the Snowden papers, we find that Stonehouse, where my father had been working, you know, was a prime site for spying on the Russians. And the NSA over years has helped build a spy network throughout Ethiopia. Like our CIA, our NSA have deep surveillance intel infrastructure in the country. And
so they don't want to rock that. Right?
They don't want to rock that. But also... Yeah. You know, also, this is a Christian country, you know, as far as the West is concerned. There are no Muslims in Ethiopia, but there indeed are.
Yeah.
But this is a Christian country in the Horn of Africa. And I think the United States for a long time really thought that it could work with that Christian country, which is also rife with racism, right?
Yep.
That understanding of this country.
Yep.
So all of this, I think... Abiy got away with a lot, and at the very beginning, when the war began, there were officials that were throwing around the G word, right, the genocide word, and I think the diaspora really shut that down. So the diaspora all over the
Ethiopian diaspora, the non-Tigrayan Ethiopian diaspora, is what you're saying.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay.
The non-Tigrayan Ethiopian diaspora staged demonstrations in D.C. and every other major city, but also around the world. And I went to one in the fall of 2020 in Washington, D.C., and it was stunning. It was enormous. Everyone was very angry. There are multiple organizations around the world that organize and motivate the diaspora. And again, we know this is a big diaspora of people who left.
And it's very active online as well.
Yes.
Although I think it was a little more of an even match online, because there are a lot of highly online Tigrayans.
But I also think that Abiy's administration is seeding a lot of this misinformation as well. But yes, absolutely. Right. The diaspora is very busy and very active. So they were demonstrating outside the State Department. And very quickly, we saw officials retreat from that genocide word.
That's interesting.
I mean, I don't mean to pick any fights or whatever, but there's been even a sort of a part of the left. I mean, we had a little friendly, I guess, spat with him or whatever about this, that there was a part of sort of the Western left that had this idea, and it was clearly came out of the non-Tigrayan diaspora and the Abi people, that that what Tigray was doing was actually some kind of, you know, U.S.-backed regime change operation, which just seemed absolutely preposterous because, I mean, I think Terse wrote about this, you know, in the first 6 months of the war before the TDF retook Mekelle, and all these massacres were going on. At Voice of America, for example, people who wanted to write about atrocities there or talk about atrocities couldn't even get their articles out or their segments posted. And there was a revolt within it eventually because everything was so obviously skewed towards the Abiy government. And it was only after the TDF stormed and took Mekelle that it seemed like you started hearing in more official organs like, oh, something really bad went on there when we weren't talking about it.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And that was Terse. I saw that piece as well. But also, you know, the Pulitzer Center made it possible for me to go do this reporting. And what I did was buddy up this piece for Harper's with another that'll come out soon at the Baffler. And the second piece, kind of the companion piece, is on how the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam, this project that was begun under the TPLF, but has, you know, Abiy's really kicked it into gear. This enormous dam, it'll be the largest on the continent, and it is upstream. So 80% of the Nile's water comes from Ethiopia. And Sudan and then Egypt are downstream. The Nile flows from south to north. And the dam has caused really tense relations with both Sudan and Egypt, but particularly Egypt, which defines itself by the Nile. Right. Something like 85% of its population lives within a mile of the Nile.
Wow.
And the Trump administration really fucked up the negotiations over the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam. And so Abiy was able to use this enormous project and, you know, just cloud it in promises that may or may not ever come to fruition. You know, promises for electrifying the country and selling the excess to neighbors and all of this. And also, like, we Ethiopians will do this together. Kind of he's used that as another way to unify the country. And I think because the United States had bungled, like Trump, you know,
How did he bungle it?
It's
well,
so bad.
No, he said publicly, you know, the Egyptians could bomb this thing.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Exactly.
Oh, God.
It wasn't just the everyday bungle. It was really, on El-Sisi's behalf, he threatened bombing the dam. It's so bad. And so I think, like, we just lost so much credibility throughout that. You know, lost more credibility.
God.
I mean, that wasn't even it. I think there were other things that the Trump administration had done. They just couldn't get Egypt to come in on it.
So, yeah, your point is like that also that just the U.S. Was even less inclined to rock the boat after all these problems, these, you know, shitstorms that were created by Trump.
Or just less credible. Right?
Less credible, right.
Less credible. Yeah. Like, you have no right to interfere in our internal operations. You know, Abiy keeps calling it, do you remember the phrase, John? Any media story said this, a policing operation or something, security operation. Minimizing term that he was using. And indeed, that's not what it has been, but that was enough cover where, you know, we just don't have credibility the way that the United States used to.
Yeah. And in practical terms, things change when you're inland and high altitude. Tigray is an easy place to choke because it's inland, high altitude. That's unlucky if you're a modern era country. You know, you can be very easily isolated. You can't raise much food. And you can easily be strangled.
Well, nobody wants the United States soldiers in the Horn of Africa. I mean, that's just never going to happen. And so I think for the sake of keeping relations with Ethiopia, the government, the U.S. administration has always looked askance at human rights violations and wars of this sort.
And what do you think of the African Union's role in the recent peace deal? Because one thing that struck me was that the Nigerian official who handled it, I forget his name.
Obasanjo.
Blamed Tigray entirely for the war. And I heard rumors that that was one of the clauses required in the treaty, like Tigray accepts blame for the deal.
I'm not surprised, right? It's like there's no such thing as a no-fault divorce in this right, peace deal right. making. But no, I mean, the world, everyone around the world said, if the African Union goes ahead with Obasanjo, who has, you know, a relationship with Abiy, how's that going to work out for Tigray? And it's worked out the way that we see, right? Indeed, after I left, after the second wave of the war, it was just so apparent that this was like wave warfare, just bodies thrown into the gaping maw of brutal warfare. So much death took place in that second wave. And something had to be done. Tigray just didn't have the resources to carry on like that. And I think they had just run out their resources to the point where it needed to stop. And they were willing to accept whatever they had to. And in that first negotiation, I get a reverse, was the first in South Africa, right? Or was it in Nairobi? Because there were two. The first, and forgive me for mixing them up, but the first really was very anti-Tigray. There were, you know, they had a hard time deciding whether it was, you know, the TPLF or the TDF or just Tigray administration who was signing the document even. But it didn't mention any of the big points that are at issue in this war. It didn't address Western Tigray. It didn't address Eritrean troops, at least not directly. Yeah. You know, it said something like foreign powers. It didn't really address the Fano and Amhara services, Amhara special forces that are also in Western Tigray and Raya. And so it was just deeply, all it did was stop the violence, which was enough, I guess.
Right.
It was enough. I mean, Tigray is uniquely vulnerable. Total population, 7 million, probably a lot less now. Inland, landlocked, remote. It can actually be extirpated. I mean, genocide is a term used very often, but in the most literal sense, it could be done. You got to make a deal.
Yes, and they did. And you're right, that violence had to stop. And my point would be that Western powers were not involved, except I think United States was kind of hovering over these deals. But Abiy refused to allow anyone but the African Union. And this is part of his thing, right? Like Pan-Africanism, we're here to take care of ourselves. We make our own decisions, down with colonialism, post-colonialism, Western influence. Yeah. And so he had the power to stick with that.
That's a good point, yeah.
This is highly unprofessional of me, but I should, you know, just anyway, for some listeners who aren't, we have talked about this war a lot since it first started, but it's still good to hold, to kind of hang on to. If you could even give a brief timeline of the war and sort of how it broke out in November 2020, and then a couple of the waves. I mean, even just kind of the big bullet points of the war.
Yeah. And John, help me out here. Like weigh in wherever you want. But I think there had been a lot of tension after Abiy came to power. And that was in 2018.
He's not Tigrayan? Because he's, Amhara and Oromo, right?
Well, Amhara, Oromo, mixed. I think at that point, it looked really good. I mean, Meles Zenawi was the Tigrayan strongman who ran Ethiopia for most of the early 21st century. He was kind of a political genius. I mean, he came out of, there's a great book that I've mentioned before called War and Negari about the genesis of these student revolutionary movements. And there's a scene there where Meles Zenawi, who's nobody at the time, takes his Tigrayan fellows out of the drink-sodden university discussions in Addis Ababa in the 1970s and said, we're going to the people. And he founds this Maoist movement that really kind of works and did a big share in fighting the Derg at that time, Eritrea and the Tigray-led Ethiopian elite were comrades right. in every sense.
So Meles and Isaias knew each other in these years and worked together to overthrow the Ethiopian government, which was run by Haile Selassie until 74, right? So these student movements were incredibly organized, and Meles and Isaias both came out as leaders. Eritrea wanted its independence and got it in 91. Ethiopia, I don't want to jump too far ahead, but the Derg took advantage of the student movement and uprising and overthrow of Haile Selassie in 74 and then ruled for a number of years. And the Derg were finally overthrown by Meles and Isaias. Ethiopia was relieved of communist and authoritarian, like very bad governance, and Eritrea got its independence. The two carried on for quite a while as friends, but then border skirmish turned into a hideous war in Badma in roughly, 2000?
Around the millennium, that's all I remember, 2000, 2001?
Yes, that's right, because I was in Ethiopia in 2007 for the millennium. So that's exactly right. Huh. I wanted to go to Eritrea then, and everybody was like, don't even try it.
Yeah.
So that was the start of a rankling relationship between these two former colleagues, comrades. And it just got worse after that. The TPLF was, the dominant force in the EPRDF, which was a coalition of various groups. The TPLF established Ethiopia.
TPLF is Tigrayan, I'm sorry, just for listeners.
Yes, but yeah. Thank you.
Tigrayan,
I'm sorry.
People's Liberation Front.
Front, yes. Yeah. And they established Ethiopia as a federation of states, and they, roughly used language to establish those borders. They said that they were going to allow individual groups to govern themselves autonomously, but that never really came to fruition in most places. They became increasingly authoritarian. Zenawi died, Meles Zenawi died in 2012, Dessalegn, Haile Mariam Dessalegn, was promoted, and his tenure was basically just riddled with riots all over the country. The government was deeply oppressive, media freedom was scant, and he stepped down.
At this point, it looked like a very corrupt regime had been overthrown. Things were looking good. There were a lot of political prisoners. They were freed by Abiy.
Yeah.
He wins the Nobel Prize. And then by early November 2020, the war begins in Tigray. I mean, and there's a lot of resentment that had been building throughout the TPLF domination. I mean, the way the Tigrayans would have seen it is like, look, we can't help it if we're more dynamic than everybody else. But at the same time, that is going to create resentment, and it did. In fact, as you mentioned, it may have created resentment in Abiy himself, who had to be like the non-Tigrayan in a mostly Tigrayan elite throughout those years and harbored a lot of sullen resentment for it.
Well, he was doing communications in the military, right? And I think that he was just super savvy in painting the TPLF as the country's default, downfall. Like everything that was wrong with Ethiopia was because of the TPLF. And Abiy has consistently hammered that point. So every problem in Ethiopia is from the TPLF, that prior 27 years of administration. And so, you know, as soon as anything was wrong, he could blame them. And leading up to the start of the war, you know, sure enough, the TPLF, which was accustomed to power and autonomy, retreated to its territory and didn't want to cooperate with the new government. They held elections even after Abiy delayed them for the pandemic, and, you know, claimed legitimate leadership over Tigray. And Abiy was consistent in saying this was an illegitimate election. And there were other small saber-rattling points on both sides. And I think it just built up the rhetoric, the fighting, the hopes for autonomous governance in Tigray. And you know, I think the Tigrayan troops have at this point admitted that they preemptively started the war by attacking a federal garrison, but will never...
Yeah, in Mekelle. They claim they knew the war was coming and they did a preemptive strike. But at any rate, they did. They struck a government bases in Mekelle. And there's so much... I mean, we could never get into it in this very limited time. But, I mean, in a sense, Ethiopia has been an imperial state and a centrifugal imperial state for a long time. And before that, it was not an imperial state. It was a collection of different cultures which were jockeying for power. And power has tended to move south from Tigray to Amhara and now toward Oromo. And that's, it's very much like a kind of San Andreas fault. That's going to cause real trouble. And nice. And all this was probably inevitable. It came in the timeline of the TPLF and the election of Abiy. And behind all this, it's a very, you know, in a very Soren-like way, is Afwerki up north saying, I can use this.
Yes. And, you know, I did another podcast recently, and the individual kept asking me, but what are they fighting about? And I wanted to say, you know, we all fight about power. It's like, this is what countries do. And the Horn is strategically very important. People want to live lives. They want to have free speech. They, you know, they want to have good governance. They want to have infrastructure. And I felt silly saying those things.
Everybody does fight about
power. I mean,
there
are rural counties trying to secede from California, for God's sake.
Yeah.
Maybe I should stop by some of them on my way out.
Way up north, exactly.
But I think some of it is, you know, that we don't have good reporting here. Nobody knows this history or how deeply involved the United States is. We aren't kept abreast of what's happening there. And so we don't understand the significance, whether it's in the number of deaths or the number of lives affected or the number of children who simply cannot go to school. Like, we just don't have that humanizing understanding.
Do you think there's a chance that, you know, a more complete account of what happened in Tigray will come out? Or do you think it'll be, you know, sort of more Rwanda-like or something? Or do you think it'll be maybe more like Yemen, where our press and sort of official agencies said for the first 5 years of Saudi Arabia, the Gulf Coalition, U.S.-backed, you know, war on Yemen, they said 10,000 dead, like, year, you know, month after month, year after year, 10,000 dead. And then sort of at some point when people kind of took their eye off the ball, it's like, yeah, actually it might have been 500,000 dead, but anyway, let's move on now.
Right. A lot of zeros after it. We know that. Yeah.
Right. I don't know. I mean, that's a hard thing to speculate, but I don't think there will be peace and clear understanding of where this country stands until it does come out.
Right.
I was going to ask you if you'd seen any hints that media will be allowed into Tigray anytime soon.
No, in fact, last week I just saw another reporter, an Ethiopian reporter, was arrested in Tigray. So effort to keep it quiet is still going on. I don't think they can do it forever. But I do think that I think we'll get a fuller picture over time. But I mean, we don't know what Abiy's future is either. I think he's very popular. He's very ruthless without looking like it.
Right.
And
a
we
great
don't
skill.
Know. It's yes. a great skill. And we don't know what his relationship with Isaias is, right? Like, what's their future going to look like? And if their purpose was to crush the TPLF, they've done so in part. They've crushed the Tigrayan people, but we know those leaders are still around. And I don't want to say that there's more war in the future, but I just don't know how you bring a nation back from this kind of horrifying polarization and division and inhumane treatment without pointing it out, without doing an accounting of what damage has been done.
Yeah. Yeah. I think your article, Falling Like Leaves, gives a good account of how much suffering and resentment is felt by a population which was maybe only in the sort of outer red zones of the H-bomb blast, you know?
Right.
And when you imagine what must be going on at ground zero, it's pretty appalling to think about.
Thank you, John.
It's a fantastic story. And what you describe, what John is alluding to, is atrocities committed by the Tigrayans as they sort of swept in and swept out of this Amhara region, of the vengeful Tigrayans moving in and out, right? So it gives you a kind of a hint of what might have been going on inside Tigray.
I'm hoping that's how it works. That was what I wanted. But I also wanted to say, this is Abiy's war.
Right.
Mm.
Wherever these atrocities exist, we can still look back at his mismanagement of things or you know, his nefarious purpose. And that should all rest with him.
You're already kind of somewhat answering this, but it seems like by unleashing this war, this full-scale, you know, atrocity-laden war that is extremely bitter and targeting civilians and is really riled up ethnic divisions in a country of 110 million with all kinds of ethnic divides, that it seems like Abiy has put at risk the future of the Ethiopian state, that it seems like it's falling apart. I mean, you just described how there's a schism, an open schism now by the leading bishops, Oromo bishops. Does it look like the state itself might go sort of Yugoslavia? I mean, if it does, it's like Yugoslavia times 10 or more, but right.
And that's not the first comparison to Yugoslavia I've heard. But I do think that the lesson here is, you know, without the top heavy history of the TPLF governing the country, I think the lesson here to all of these nation states that want their own independence, I'm sorry, regional states that want their own independence from Ethiopia, is that we can crush you.
Right.
Yeah.
And we're looking at the southern states, Sadama, who is moving toward, like, the constitution as written by the TPLF is still in effect, guarantees an unprecedented amount of independence to these states. And, you know, when I talked to Berhanu Nega, who's the Minister of Education, who is, you know, formed Jinbat 7, an anti-TPLF militia group, you know, like, he was a Rutgers professor for a while. He's a fascinating character. Huh. But he said, oh, no, we have a commission that is reexamining the Constitution. We're going to rewrite it. And indeed, everyone you talk to says this Constitution is the cause of the war, not Abiy, not, you know, a hyperactive TPLF that wants their independence. They're blaming the Constitution. And I think now we're going to see the current administration move on those changes. And then what does that mean for all of these independence groups, you know, the OLA?
Because the Oromo are the most numerous group in Ethiopia.
Right.
Traditionally, they've only been auxiliaries, partners in power. And it was the Habesha who really ran things. But that won't last forever.
No, and the way that Abiy has treated the Oromo has not been good. Like, sending in troops, you know, there was a very famous singer who was killed before the start of the war. Just like, he's mishandling it in every way because he's not that skilled with keeping the peace, you know. He can talk unity, but he doesn't have the power or reach to do it, to keep it.
I think that's a very good distinction about Abiy. He's very good at managing the spin. but the events that he has to spin are not very brilliantly planned.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. So I think that's the future of the country, right? Like, how does he negotiate this federation? Does it mean changing the constitution? Is he going to move in a more authoritarian direction? Well, of course he is. He's already done that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's mm-hmm. that's his inclination. He,
right.
you know, he thinks he's appointed by God.
Yes.
Like,
yes.
like he's, yeah. he's got some problems
as a
ruler.
His mother told him.
Yeah.
So he's not necessarily working toward democracy, despite all of the rhetoric.
Right.
And I think that's a huge problem.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And now he's got a lot of people sort of who bloodied their hands to, I mean, he's got a lot of people sort of invested in going down with the Abhi ship or keeping it going for their own sake as well, I would imagine. Like, so much blood has been spilled.
Right.
So, yeah.
Right.
God.
Yeah.
Anyway, this is a story that we're going to all keep our eyes on. And it's really heartbreaking, among other things. And
it really is, because it's such an amazing population. The Ethiopia had, it was zooming. They were really exciting people. It's too bad.
Well, it's also an ancient culture. I just want to say, Mario, who I write about, who was my guide when I was there, we are in regular contact via WhatsApp. But after I left the country, he was quiet for a number of weeks. And I tried everything to get in touch with him, his family. And finally, he let me know that he had been detained by the Oromo. Oh. He's Amhara. Mm. He lived on the outskirts of Addis in Oromo territory, because, of course, Oromo surrounds Addis Ababa. So he lived in one of these new houses that the state built. We don't know if he was seen with me, and that's why he was detained, or what was taking place. But when he got out after 6 weeks of detention, he and his girlfriend Jeanette decided that he would leave the country. And he bought a ticket to Europe. And his first stop was in Italy, and he had less than $100 on him. And so he is now in a refugee camp outside of Rome in Italy. And I'm writing a letter saying, this man's life is in danger.
Wow.
You can't send him back to his country. And so talk about the sausage making. That's a whole coda to this piece that's incredibly powerful. I'm going to, you know, he has a hearing in March. If they're allowing visitors, I'm going to go and see if I can just, I don't know, wave my white ass around and get him some some attention or safety. But I think this is a huge part of the story, right? Not only is it difficult to go to this country and do this kind of reporting from the outside, it's dangerous, if not to the reporter, but to others. We know this from Afghanistan and elsewhere.
Right.
But that's a sign that the country is also not doing well.
Right. Yeah. And also, I just want to add, I know we have listeners and subscribers even in Italy. If anybody thinks they can do any, in any way, could help Mario.
Thank you.
Just like send us a note or something and we'll pass it on.
Yeah, we may be back in Italy by then. We'll see.
Incredible. Yeah. Well, let me know. Maybe I can meet up with some people. He doesn't have any cold clothes. He's never been out of the country. He's magnificent with languages, so he's taking Italian classes. But, you know, it's still, Italy's not the best country for refugees either.
God, they have an actual fascist in power right now.
Exactly.
I mean, God.
Italy's been pretty decent to a lot of, I mean, They've borne the brunt.
The political system at the moment. Like, there's a difference between...
Yeah, the people would be the first to tell you that, yeah.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, he's not home. He's apart from his girlfriend and his family, and his family rely on him for income, and he's not providing that right now. So I mean, that's a heartbreak on top of heartbreak.
Yeah. God, that's horrifying. All right. Well, anyway, I mean, this is a grim story, so it's not like we should end on any sort of happy note. I think it's an appropriately grim and sad way to end the conversation. But I really want to thank you, Anne Newman, for spending a lot of time actually talking with us about, you know, what you saw and your whole history there. It's really fascinating, like your personal family background in Eritrea and all of that. It's an amazing story. I have a feeling you're going to be writing a lot more about this, that there are a lot more stories.
Yeah, if I can get this book off the ground, thank you.
Yeah,
But also, it's been a real pleasure. I mean, this story can't go anywhere on social media because there are people suing Facebook for inciting violence, suing Facebook and Meta. So this story is not going anywhere on Facebook. And Twitter, I think, has, you know, Twitter's seen the chaos of this war and the misinformation, and it doesn't go anywhere on Twitter either. So
that's terrible.
The fact that you had me on means a lot to me, and also
we'll blast it out.
we'll blast your story out.
Yeah,
but you're so smart and knowledgeable about it as well. So it's been a pleasure.
Oh, thanks.
Thank you very much.
Well, really enjoyed it. Thank you again to Anne Newman. I will be posting links to the story and as well as to your book. And we look forward to reading more from you and hopefully to have you on again.
Thank you, gentlemen. Have a beautiful day. Thank you.
Thank you. You too.
Thanks. You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Okay, that was our interview with Anne Newman, and we'll post links again to her article in Harper's, Falling Like Leaves, The War in Ethiopia and Its Crimes Against Civilians. I mean, as she said, the big takeaway, that you know, this war is Abby's war. That's a really, I mean, that just, if you had to just sum it up, that's it. You know, she was able to see the crimes against the Amhara, but it's really, it's Abby's war. And
and the crimes are going to be worse when you get closer to Ground Zero, which is the province of Tigray.
Yeah.
So,
and we're not done with the crimes either. It's pretty damn clear. Yeah. I mean, we're going to have a lot more of this. But anyway, what a great guest. I mean, it was so pleasant. It was so nice talking to her. I can't tell you. I mean, after the Seymour Hersh, it's like... you know, going from the working class Chicago Jew, have you've read Reporter, right? His memoir.
Yeah.
It's a great memoir, by the way. Not least because he mentions me, but no. Yeah. But going from that to this really just pleasant, intelligent, and just very personable, nice, not intimidating, but smart and intelligent and not after like trying to rip my throat out. Mennonite, yay Mennonites. Yeah. I'm like, I'm all for Mennonites now. Yeah. Anyway, thank you, Anne, for being nice.
Thanks, Anne.
We appreciate it. Anyway, John, you said you had one quick story you wanted to tell, too.
It's just too good to pass up, so I'll do it quickly.
Yes. Yeah.
An F-22 shot down at great expense.
Yes.
A threatening balloon over the Yukon with the cooperation of the supine Canadian government.
And, the Trudeau regime, as we call it.
Yeah. And after this... a group called the Northern Illinois Bottle Cap Balloon Brigade phoned in to say, that might have been one of ours because we last tracked it over Western Alaska and it was heading east with the wind. And we have one of these apps that allows us to plot where it would have ended at that point that the F-22 fired, and kind of looks like ours. This thing costs about $12. it's a bunch of coated plastic with a, and it was shot down at the expense of probably a couple of million dollars at the very least by an F-22. So I guess the big scare is over. Not that it ever made any sense.
Yeah.
And nobody's going to apologize. Nobody's even embarrassed, but they'll shut up about it.
People so badly wanted to believe, first that it was China. The MAGA people really wanted to believe like there was a whole China threat there. But then everybody else really wanted to believe aliens had to have something to do with it. And they just thought it was so cool. It's like, no, it's just so much more depressing and grim than that. It's just spending a ton of money and working out your just like decadent freaking imperial pathologies on some poor balloons. It's just it's pathetic. I mean, there's nothing else. It's actually it should be freaking really embarrassing, but as you said, no one's embarrassed at all. It's I think it's considered treason to be embarrassed. It plays into Russians' hands if you're embarrassed about it. So yeah, so that's where we are. What a joke. I remember I had a friend, Alan. Alan Colson, Wall Street Journal. I remember him telling me he was really getting into some years ago into weather balloons. He's like, you can make them go so high up and it's really cool. And I never really thought much about it. And then, you know, here we have that club in Illinois. I mean, that's the greatest thing that'll ever happen to him. At least
bottle
give them
cap
that.
Balloon Brigade of Illinois. You can't top that.
No.
America's new enemy.
the bottle cap balloon
Brigade.
Yeah, yeah. There's got to be some Kremlin link there, you know, or Beijing link. There's got to be. We got to find that.
Yeah. Well, anyway. I remember a movie called The Red Balloon. Hey.
Yes, yes.
Think about it.
Red. Yeah, it makes you think.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Anyway, thanks again to our guest, Anne Newman, and thank you, everybody, and I'll talk to you again soon.
Okay. Thanks, everybody. Bye.
Bye.